This is the order of battle!
Thanks for joining the Order of Battle podcast for another episode. Joel, Jason, and Sometimes A discuss collecting G.I. Joe, other 1/18 scale action figures, and in general, what sparks joy. It's a lot of things, but almost always toys. This is the Order of Battle podcast. At Assembly Required in November, I and many others had the privilege of meeting Michael Hill. He was a producer on close to 70 G.I. Joe episodes. He also wrote 5 G.I. Joe episodes with Sunbow and with Deke, including Cold Slither. He was also the writer for the audio play that was on the Special Mission Brazil cassette tape. And he gave the name and background file card to Claymore. If you're into Transformers, he also did quite a bit on Transformers, including creating the Bounty Hunter DevCon. He has an incredibly storied past beyond that simple intro. You can catch the panel he did at Assembly Required on Hooded Cobra Commander 788's YouTube channel. And he also recently sat down with David T. Allen for the G.I. Joe New News Review. I loved this conversation. I expect you're going to love it too. So let's just dig in.
Early on, when we were recording the episode, what Wally would do would be a table read. So the first part of the day, I can't remember what time we started, 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. All the actors, voiceover actors, sitting around a table in the booth where they actually recorded it. Because Wally would have made notes based on the screenplay of the episode that the actors did not have. All they had were their lines and sort of fill in what was happening during the scene and how their character should feel and react and whatnot. So that was really great. So that gave him a better sense. But as time went on, because it would take up the whole day, and a lot of actors, especially people like Frank Welker, be only their character would have 3 or 4 lines, and they just thought, well, can I just record these lines first, get out of here, so I can do this other session. So that's, over time, what it evolved to.
One of the things that I found really interesting after you did your panel at Assembly Required was I was talking to a couple of our archivists. Some of the stuff you were telling, none of us knew. It was new information.
Like what?
Well, just about Claymore, for example. And so, you know, I know with Claymore, and we didn't talk about this at the panel. We had talked about it drinking in the lobby after the show. But like Claymore's last name was is that your mother's maiden name? Or he's from your mother's hometown and
it was my great-grandfather on my mother's side, yeah.
And then, you know, so all these pieces of Claymore come from your personal life. I know in the panel you talked about why Brazil as your special mission. And so stuff like that, any of those stories that you want to talk about or tell or share, like that's really what we're here for. But I did find it interesting that a lot of that stuff, we just assumed Larry wrote Claymore because he wrote everyone else.
And I can understand that. And it never occurred to me at the time to take any credit for it or embrace it as mine. Mm-hmm. Like I think I had said at Assembly Required, it was one of the few times that Hasbro did not even send me the box set that they were selling. They sent us everything else. I think I told you we had a USS flag in our lounge area that we were using as a coffee table. So I never, at the time, sort of embraced the idea that this was something that I had created. It was just part of my responsibility, the same way as writing the PSAs. It was just part of my, as producer of the show, part of my responsibility. Or occasionally, I'd get a phone call from Carol Weitzman or fax saying, Joe and Tom want you to take a swing at writing a Bible for this new show.
And Joe and Tom would be Bacall, right? Griffin and Bacall.
Bacall and Tom Griffin. Some new toy that Hasbro was developing. The one I remember the most was something called Air Raiders.
Oh, yeah.
They wanted me to write a Bible for it. Just come up with, here are the toys. Give us your take on what the show would be about. Well, it wasn't until recently. I had no idea that apparently Doug Booth did the same thing and Ron Friedman did the same. I don't know if they did it before me or they did it after, but I thought I was the only one that had worked on it. And ultimately, the show wasn't a go.
That's a very small toy line. A lot of the toys for Air Raiders were designed by Ron Rudat, who designed a lot of the G.I. Joe toys.
So it was just all, I didn't really at the time, and for many, many years afterwards, just didn't really give a lot of thought to things that I had created. Old Slither, I sort of was aware of and recognized myself. And it probably wasn't until my son was in college when he started telling me that, I guess he was at the time looking to join a fraternity. People were coming up and asking me, is your father Michael Charles Hill? And did he create Right Cold Silver? And so it was just surprising to me that all these years later, people would even know about it. At the time we were working on the show, well, I'm pretty sure we were aware that ratings-wise, G.I. Joe and Transformers were doing well. I think at one point, the top five shows were all Sunbow shows.
Yeah, they were monsters.
But, there was no fan conventions, at least none that we were aware of. And we just assumed that, once the show went off the air, some new toy come in, and that would be the new hot property that people would be all excited about, and people would forget about G.I. Joe and Transformers. So for many, many years, I did not realize that that was not the case. And then I started seeing, like on Bandcamp, people were doing Cold Slither covers. And then I started seeing on the internet Cold Slither t-shirts that people were doing. And it was just kind of like, wow. So even still, I guess at some point, I don't know if I discussed this before, I started noticing Flint, for example, was doing a lot of convention appearances, and I think Buzz was as well. And I never sort of compared my contribution to the franchise to theirs. Just what, Flint had going for him was the movie, plus, and humanoids. And so I started contacting the different conventions, but never really getting any response. So I thought, all right, well, they're just, for whatever reason, they're not interested in it. So whatever I did is not enough to sort of warrant my making an appearance. And the final straw for me was BotCon 2014 in Pasadena, just over the hill from me. They're exclusive that year. There were five of them, and one of them was a character that I had created, which up until then had never been a toy.
And that's DevCon.
That's DevCon, because when I wrote that episode, my very first episode, nobody told me I couldn't create my own Transformer, so I did. I didn't know that he became a fan favorite, even though, screen time, he only has like 2 or 3 minutes. But apparently he was iconic enough as a bounty hunter, because he really wasn't an Autobot, but he definitely wasn't accepted. That people were intrigued by this guy. So I introduced myself to the folks at BotCon. I said, as the original creator, it'd be nice if you guys would give me one of these. And he said, oh, sure, come on by. So I took the train to Pasadena. Registration area announced who I was and who I was supposed to be. And the guy showed up maybe 15 minutes later and literally just handed me this little plastic bag and said, thanks. And that was it. And I thought, oh, geez, you got this big Transformers convention. I'm here. Why wouldn't you want to take advantage? And just decided, okay, I'm done. I'm not going to pursue any more of this, because clearly, and at the time, I think it was more of a focus was on voiceover
actors. Well, I think voiceover actors are easier to find. Voiceover actors, they're going to voice the same character for 30, 40 episodes. But like yourself, you are a producer on over 80 G.I. Joe. a writer, you did three that you were given writing credit, even though you wrote all the PSAs. So it's just harder to find the writers, I think, sometimes. Everybody knows the showrunner. Everybody knows the voice actors. I am baffled by, like, if you showed up at my door and identified yourself as somebody who worked on a property that I'm obsessed enough to run a convention, I'm buying you drinks at the very best, at the very minimum.
My thinking was, why wouldn't you be interested in talking to people who were there?
Yeah.
For whatever reason, it didn't work out that way. In 2019, they contacted me that they were doing a show in Burbank, again, over the hill. And would I be available to attend? They didn't really give me enough advance notice. So I think I might have already been in Hawaii. My girlfriend and I, so we go twice a year. In March, celebrate our birthdays, and then in October. So the way I remember it was I responded by saying, okay, well, I'm in Hawaii. I'm coming back late Saturday night. You know, I can show up Sunday for a couple hours. And that was my first introduction. So really, I don't really count it so much as my first convention because I was only there for a few hours. So it wasn't until this past July when I went to TFCon Toronto where I feel like, okay, that was my first convention experience. And I thought it was great. And I decided I want to do more of these. And now I see they're doing a show next November in Baltimore, which my earliest memories of being aware, I was living in Baltimore. And my father was on the Baltimore Police Department. And he was a big Orioles and Colts fan and used to take me to the games at Memorial Stadium. And so I have a lot of really fond memories. And I thought, oh, it'd be nice to go back to Baltimore, have some soft shell crabs. My son lives not far away from Baltimore, so it'd be a great opportunity to see him. So I'm hoping to have that discussion with Colin in March about keeping me in mind for Baltimore in November. Plus, there's some big transformer group in the D.C., Baltimore metro area who have become big fans of mine. So it'd be an opportunity for all of us to meet in person.
When we were talking in Des Moines, you had mentioned that you are still a lifelong Orioles fan.
And this was a great season until the last three games.
So over the years of following the one team and then living bicoastally, because you are from the East Coast, you live on the West Coast. I don't know how many arguments you've had to get into about your sports team out in California.
Actually, none. Because I know plenty of Dodger fans, but most of my closest friends that I would have a reason to discuss baseball with are from somewhere else. Like Steve Mitchell, my writing partner, he's a Yankees fan because he's from New York. And I would imagine Cy, you know, one of our showrunners, he's from Cincinnati. So I imagine he's a Reds fan. But I don't think we've ever discussed baseball. So it hasn't been a problem for me. You know, it looked like it might have happened this year at the World Series had Baltimore prevailed. It looked like there was a possibility of an Orioles-Dodgers World Series. But both teams lost their last three games, which were the first three games for them at the playoffs. They both got swept.
So the dream is over for this year.
Once again. Yeah, but, you know, I don't wear the baseball cap anymore. I never wore one of the jerseys or a T-shirt. You know, not. When I was living in back in Vermont, but even more so when I was living in Northampton, Massachusetts, you know, it's Red Sox and Patriots country. And I just, you know, I'm definitely going to offend some people, but I just love them, how passionate they are.
Yeah.
At some point, you know, you got to make room for other people's passion for other teams.
And I know this is way off the G.I. Joe topic, but I mean, hell, we're talking about Transformers and Orioles now. Obviously, you've met whether Colin and all the people that you met in Toronto or in Des Moines with Brian, myself, and Tim, and everybody else that you hung out with. We are clearly very passionate about these things from our childhood that we've carried with us all the way to adulthood. What passion do you have that you carry? Because I know when we talked, you didn't grow up with action figures.
when I was 10 years old, when G.I. Joe was first introduced, and I really wanted it. But my father, former Marine, chief of police of my small town, was not going to allow his son to play with dolls. I know my sister had Barbies, and she was is a year younger than me. So yeah, I never had a G.I. Joe. So I was into comics, and I was into Matchbox cars and HO scale trains.
So he did not buy into the marketing ploy of action figure and putting them in uniforms. He still saw them as dolls, and that was the end of it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you still deal with Matchbox cars.
I still have all my old ones.
Nice.
And I was never into Hot Wheels. They were really cheaply made. And they didn't, I don't think they had the license for any real vehicles at the time. They were just making shit up and paint job. But also, in 68, was my first year of high school. So I was more interested in real cars, and girls, and music at the time.
It was a great time to grow up for music.
So it wasn't until much later I stumbled on what Hot Wheels was doing. There's a guy who lives here in L.A. named Magnus Walker, and he builds and designs his outlaw Porsches. And so he had a deal with Hot Wheels to make little miniatures of cars. And I went, oh, wow, these aren't the Hot Wheels I remember. So, I kind of got sucked back into collecting 164th diecast.
That's kind of a cool collection. Do you still mess with trains at all?
No. I still have my original train set, again, back in storage in Vermont. I'd love to be able to do something with it. But I just kind of feel, you know, at my age, it's a little late in the game to become a serious collector about anything.
Sure.
In less than 3 months' time, I turned 70. So, it just doesn't feel quite like I should be really getting into the collecting game. But there's still some things I'm passionate about. You know, I'm still buying books from my, hardcover first editions from my favorite writers. You know, that's not slowing me down. And as far as G.I. Joe and Transformers go, even though, as I said earlier, Hasbro used to send us everything. Well, I didn't keep any of that, which, what they would be worth still in the box.
Right.
So I ended up giving a lot of that stuff to my son and my nephew and, other people like that. It's only been maybe in the last 6 months where it occurred to me, gee, it would be really nice for me to have, at the very least, figures that I created. So the very first one I got was one of the members of the staff at TFCon Toronto, who was sort of my handler, gifted me the DevCon character that Hasbro had just released. And I didn't even hear about it till the night that I arrived in Toronto. I didn't even know it existed. Although I did have that BotCon one, which was, not quite as detailed. At the same time, the whole Captain Claymore and Special Mission Brazil, it really wasn't even on my mind. I wasn't thinking that, oh yeah, that's something else I did. The way Cold Slither was, because I'm constantly reminded of that. And I know that, I think at San Diego Comic-Con, maybe 2011, they came out with a Special Mission Brazil 2 exclusive. And of course, I don't have it. I guess the only one I would be interested in would be Claymore because I created him. I don't even think I remember originally. I knew that the other four characters were going to be already existing characters. I don't remember if Hasbro told me that they were going to repaint them.
Yeah, they were repainted.
But I don't think I even knew that at the time that was, and then writing the script for the audio cassette.
I know you're in the middle of a story, but to kind of help add part of that was when you, did they give you a list of, did they tell you which characters were going to be in the set, or did you get to help choose the other four characters?
They either told me which ones they were going to be or they didn't, but I don't have any memory of suggesting characters it would be.
So you just worked on Claymore and then you wrote the script for the cassette tape.
Right. Because all they told was that my job, my responsibility, was to come up with this fifth character that they were going to make from some spare parts. They didn't even tell me what spare parts they were using. So that's what I did. So, yeah, they probably did tell me which other characters they were going to use, because I had to know that when I was writing the script.
Right. The thing that I love about Mission Brazil is that in when we talked, I don't think you knew this at the time, or you had forgotten about it, but the backside of the tape was left blank for a kid to record their own mission.
Which was a brilliant idea, and I'm sure it wasn't mine.
Well, I'm sure a lot of those tapes got recorded on the wrong side, because...
You know, I stumbled on some postings with people talking about remembering listening to the tape, or they found their old tape, or they just, you know, reacquired the old tape. And I haven't heard or seen anyone talk about how they recorded on the wrong side. Very few people have actually talked about their own recording, but just a few days ago, somebody had mentioned how he and his brother had recorded their own story.
Oh, that's amazing.
And they had just recently listened to it, and what a kind of surreal experience it was for them.
When I was in San Diego in 2017, and I try to get back to the West Coast every couple of years, but I picked up the tape at a shop in San Diego, and I bring it home, and I'm digitizing the tape, and just on a lark, I flip it over to listen to the blank half, and there was a kid's recording on there. So I digitized that, and I was trying to find it for you today. If I come across it, I'll send it to you. I've archived it somewhere. But I do find that to be a very charming thing that I didn't have this as a kid. But I remember recording our own things all the time. What a fun time in our collective history that I don't know how kids are doing that today. That's certainly an artifact of the 80s and the 70s that I truly love.
Yeah, it's kind of like the 80s was a bridge to sort of the way things were in my childhood. And then the 90s and especially 2000s and since, it's, you know, this new land that I feel like it's hard to cross back over that bridge again.
It really is. It really is. Since Brian and I are friends, we sat down after Assembly Required with him, and just instead of Joel and I just talking about, oh, here's the things we bought in Iowa, we sat with Brian and said, as the guy who ran the show with Travis and their team, what was that like? How did it, you know, how was this year compared to previous years? And he had told us how the two of you guys connected, sent messages back and forth, ended up getting on the phone, and he convinced you to come to Des Moines in November. I think it's excellent how the tables have turned for you, whereas in 2014, people weren't noticing, but now between TFCon this year and Brian and everybody else that's been chatting with you, like, I'm really glad you're here. And I don't know, did Brian know anything about Claymore when he invited you out, or was this strictly over one of your five written, your G.I. Joe scripts, because you did the Cold Slither episode? I mean, you also did, what was it, Ninja Holiday and I Will Sneak Into Your Bed Tonight or something?
Yeah, what is that? Into Your Tent, I Will Silently Creep.
Into Your Tent, I Will Silently Creep, yes. I butchered that. And then there were a couple from Deke, which that's a whole other interesting thing. But, you know, did he know about the Claymore stuff, or was it really just a Dreadnought conversation?
It was just a Dreadnought conversation. During the course of the conversation, I think maybe we talked for about an hour, because the conversation just kind of evolved. I happened to throw it out there because as we were talking, I was remembering things I had done working on Sunbow. Because I was only kind of focused on Cold Slither because the promotion that he was doing focused on Cold Slither. And it was just kind of a throwaway thing. And so he was surprised to hear this. and was telling me, oh man, that's a really rare character, really, you know, hard, you know, everybody's Holy Grail and they're really expensive. And it was just something I hadn't even thought about for a while. And wasn't aware with that it was rare, that it was popular. You know, I just thought it was one of those things that, you know, maybe there was a limited number made, although I think I have recently learned there were 15,000 units made and sold out like that. So, yeah, so that came up during the conversation. But in that conversation, I will tell you one thing I've never been very good at is any kind of self-promotion. I remember years ago, Flint Dilley and I were in the same class, but we didn't know each other yet. In class with John Milius. And he said he was in the process. I think he was in post-production on Conan. That's how far back this goes. And he said many quotable things. But one of the things he said that always stuck with me is, you're not a writer until somebody else says you're a writer. Because, you know, everybody in Hollywood says they're a screenwriter and they got a copy of something in their trunk or whatever. So I sort of took that to heart. And so I've never really been good at self-promotion. But after my experience at TFCon Toronto, and I decided, you know, I really like to do more of these things. Felt like, well, I got to get out there and start letting people know that I exist. I went back to what I said I wouldn't do again after my BotCon 2014 experience. I started contacting different events and introducing myself. And during my research, I kept stumbling across Codename Iowa Assembly Required. But I didn't have a sense that it was a big event compared to what I remembered. I think Hasbro in some way was connected to BotCon.
They were up until 2016.
And I guess there was a JoeCon.
And they were connected to JoeCon up until 2018.
Okay. So I was looking for something like that. And of course, then I realized, well, JoeCon doesn't exist anymore. So it wasn't until I started seeing Ryan posting photos of what appeared to be an FBI bulletin dot matrix printout.
Yes.
And when I started to read them, and it kept talking about Cold Slither, and what I had been doing sort of to dip my toe in the water, anytime somebody would say something positive about Cold Slither or the work I did on Transformers, or would do a custom version or a piece of art, I would just respond, you know, as the original creator, I approve. And I kind of did that with Brian, not thinking anything would really come of it. And I think he responded fairly quickly with some kind of a thank you. My response was, well, you know, if you're interested, I'm available for appearances. And that's how the ball started rolling. And I think it might have taken a couple of weeks before I had a phone call. I'm sure he wanted to talk to Travis and some other people about the feasibility of it. And even at some point, I don't know whether it's via Facebook or what was on the phone, but Brian had said, well, are you sure this is something you really want to do? You know, we're kind of a small gathering. You know, it's mostly friends, maybe only 300 people will show up to this thing. But by this time, he had filled me in on that the focus of the show this particular year was Dreadnoughts, but first night, the focus was on Cold Slither. And I said, well, it just sounds like it would be a missed opportunity for the both of us. Now, part of it was I felt uncomfortable because I felt like I was really pushing him towards inviting me, maybe being a little overbearing, you know, at least from my point of view. Because I really wanted to get on that train of G.I. Joe conventions and thought, well, this is an ideal one. And it'd be a good way to kick off what I hope will be future appearances. So I just said, well, you know, if you think it makes sense, if you can afford to, you know, fly me out there and put me up, I'd say I think this would be a missed opportunity. I guess he had another conversation with Travis et al. And so then I got the official invite.
When he and I met before the show, just, you know, to help promote his show, one as a fan and two as a friend, he had told me that Josh was coming. We had talked about some other stuff, and he was like, "And I've got a bit of a secret that it's not 100% worked out, but I think it's going to be amazing. You're going to love the other person I'm trying to bring." And so I guess we sat down and talked right while you guys were working out the details. So he didn't tell me who you were, but just that I would be floored when I showed up. And of course, that's what we put out into the world. Like, all right, guys, Josh Blaylock's going to be there. Josh is already known by a lot of us. He's been around for a while. He's been gone for a while. We all know and love Josh. He's great fun to chat with. And then someone else, we are not announcing who yet. And I think a couple weeks later, once you guys finished it, he announced it and everything. And all of us were like, oh, this is going to be fun. This is going to be exciting. But had no idea that you weren't just going to be behind a table and do a panel, but you were going to hang out with all of us. You were going to be in the mix, drinking with us until all hours, and being very, very giving of your time.
It never occurred to me to do anything otherwise. It's like, I didn't come here to spend, you know, hang out in my hotel room.
Absolutely.
Until I was, you know, doing a panel. You know, I was interested in engaging because there's, you know, there's so much, because I only know from what, you know, that small span of time that I worked on it. And then it's like I never even saw the G.I. Joe movie.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I would have seen it because it was originally supposed to be released while I was still working at Sunbo. But because the Transformer movie was a commercial failure, it was a flop, I think De Laurentiis, but maybe it was all parties, agreed that they were not going to release the G.I. Joe movie theatrically. And because of that, I think the release of video was delayed. I think it was released until after I left Sunbo. And by then, you know, I was already on to other things. I don't even remember when it came out.
The movie came out in 87.
Okay. Okay, so that wasn't long after I left Sunbo. So I think it was, I think I was still there in 87. In any event, I have no memory of seeing the movie.
In terms of, you know, you leaving in 87, I don't know, are you aware that G.I. Joe and Cops, because you worked on Cops and Crooks in 88.
I think it was just called Cops.
Yeah. I think the toy line was called Cops and Crooks. The TV show was just Cops. You had written at least one episode. They exist in the same universe.
I don't think I was aware of that.
Yeah. One of the characters from the Cops card from Cops is like the grandson of a G.I. Joe.
Huh.
You know, and then you guys used to use a Geraldo Rivera stand-in in the G.I. Joe cartoons. And so that has tied G.I. Joe to Jim and the Holograms and to Transformers. What a shitheel character. We all love him.
I think Hector is a Buzz Dixon invention.
Okay. And aside from him, Flint and Lady J have a child in the Transformers universe. So there's a character, Marissa Fairborn, that exists in the Transformer universe that is the daughter of Flint and Lady J from G.I. Joe.
Oh, that's right. I think I used her in an episode that I wrote called The Killing Job. Because there's a fight scene, I'm using quotation marks, between her and her father, but it's not real. It's an illusion. But at the time, she's not aware of it. Well, and I guess Cold Cylinder Music, I know the song without lyrics was used in another G.I. Joe. So the USS Flag, yes, they use some of the music in Transformers as well, and maybe even with lyrics like in the background, but I'm not 100% certain on that.
I didn't know that. All of these little strings that tie all of these properties together is very fun. I tend to like all of the different properties, but I know some people are just one or the other. One of the things that interests me is that there's been a couple people from Sunbo. I don't know if it was Flint Dilly or if it was Buzz that had talked about kind of refusing to work with Deke because of their practices. But then a lot of other people did work with them. And you wrote two episodes with Deke. an officer and a viperman, or a gentleman and no, an officer and a viperman, because that's an officer and a gentleman.
Yeah.
And then A Shadow of a Doubt. And how was it to work with Deke versus Sunbow? How was it to work on a much sillier version versus a little more serious sci-fi? I know it's weird to call Sunbow serious, but
yeah,
in comparison.
I think the way I remember it was that Buzz may have been offered a job as story editor, but they weren't offering him enough money, which Deke was notorious for. They just, you know, they didn't pay, even in script fees, they didn't pay what other studios paid. So Doug Booth became the story editor. I don't know if Flint was ever approached to write episodes or not, but Flint might have been busy, you know, with many various different projects he was involved in at the time.
Sure.
So I don't have a very strong memory of it, other than Doug Booth must have called me and said, hey, would you like to... You know, we're doing Sunbow over at Deke. I mean, we're doing G.I. Joe over at Deke. How would you like to write for it? And I think I just said, sure. So I really just did it for the money. Now, I had some experience with Deke in other shows that they had done that maybe I had pitched for but didn't get assignments. I wrote the pilot episode of the American version of Sailor Moon for them.
That's incredible.
Because I had experience in writing English language scripts for Japanese animation. Because I'd done Saber Rider and the Star Sheriffs. I did some features like Space Adventure Cobra. And Deke, the way I remember it was, all the writing and post work was going to be done in Canada. Because they were going to save money. Plus, Deke was sort of a Canadian co-production company to begin with. But none of the writers that they had attached to the show knew how to write the sort of technically how to fit dialogue to fit lip sync. And it's time consuming, it's labor intensive, because you literally have to go frame by frame from the moment his mouth opens till the final close. And you also have to have a rough translation or even a literal translation and then translate that into, you know, normal speech. So for whatever reason, people at D told me the Canadian writers couldn't do that. They wanted me to do it to show them how to do it. And for that, they were willing to pay me extra money, but because they also could not give me credit for screen credit because contract with Canadian writers.
Sure.
But Deke also was not the only studio, but their specialty needed to be limited animation. And by that, I mean, and you're probably aware of this, you know, you just have a lot of scenes where the character is talking, the camera's behind his head, so they don't have to animate his mouth moving, and everything else is frozen. Or if you do have a character talking that you see on screen, again, everything is just frozen and it's just minimal amount of open, shut, open, shut, open, shut. Or they would also just, they didn't cut very often. So there'd, you know, just be long static scenes. So even though maybe Deke paid half as much for a script than say Sunbow did, their page count was also probably half as much as well because of the limited animation. But anyway, go back to your original question. I did it for the money. I think I was working at Disney at the time with Marv Wolfman. We were editing the comics section of Disney Adventure magazine. I was also working as a freelance story analyst at MGM. So every night after I'd leave Disney, I'd drive over to MGM, pick up some scripts I would read the night before. I mean, the night of. And deliver first thing in the morning, the next morning. And then two nights a week, I was working at Golden Apple Comics.
Wow.
I don't know if you've heard of them before.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think Mondays and Friday nights, I was working at Golden Apple Comics. Just, it was fun to hang out.
You decided you just didn't need sleep during this period of time.
I guess not. Well, you know, I think also at this period of time, my then wife had got a job in New York City. She was working on a records as a publicist. She got a job at maybe Chrysalis Records or Polydor, one of those. And so she and our two kids had to be in New York by the first of the year. And I didn't show up till 3 months later because I needed to secure a job as well. And that's how I ended up working at DC. So for those 3 months, you know, I was sort of on my own. And so I could afford to not sleep and take all these different jobs. So to this day, I have never seen those Deke episodes.
I have.
I just knew how bad that they would be.
Deke is not the most favorably received. It's still fun. It's still G.I. Joe. I mean, I still have them on DVD as well as can stream them. So you mentioned your comics work and working for somebody like Marv Wolfman or working with someone like Marv Wolfman. That's insane. You came into comics at the right time to work with a lot of the old heads.
I did. I was originally hired by Dick Giordano.
Yeah.
It's a VP, but, you know, a famous inker in his own right, especially with his work with Neil Adams.
Yeah.
So he originally hired me to, they were just starting this new imprint that were the trade paperbacks. I forgot what they were calling them. They hadn't done before. So that I did that for, I think, the first year that I was there. But then Joe Orlando lured me away to go upstairs and work with him in special projects, you know, and offered me more money than, you know, what Dick was paying. And Joe Orlando, you know, is another one of those guys who is famous in his own right.
Yeah.
Who also happened to be, you know, best friends with Wally Wood. In fact, I think he was his best man at his wedding. And then, you know, the other thing I loved about being in D.C. was hanging out with Archie Goodwin.
Oh, wow.
Denny O'Neill. Now, previously, I had worked with Jack Kirby. Jack was, you know, he'd already moved out to California. And I think when I was working at Ruby Spears, which was the first time I had done any animation, he was working at Ruby Spears. But he may have had an office, but he rarely showed up. So I don't have any memory of ever running into him at Ruby Spears. But a few years earlier, I had worked on a project with him. And I'll start by asking you, are you familiar with the movie Argo?
Yes.
And so you know the basic premise of Argo.
It's been a long time.
It's the Iranian hostage crisis in 1979. And a CIA agent is responsible for trying to figure out how to get these Americans out of Iran. And it turns out that one of the people he works with is this makeup artist in Hollywood named John Chambers. John Chambers comes up with an idea of how to do it. He says, oh, I've been working on this project. It's just never going to get made. And we'll use that as a cover story. Now, they called. All they did was change, literally print up a new cover page. They changed the original title of the script to Argo and took full page ads out in the trades, which I remember seeing those full page ads. Did not think anything of it at the time. Well, it turns out that Argo was originally a project called Lord of Light, which was a Roger Zelazny novel. And the guy who owned the rights to it and who wrote the script and was trying to get the movie made was a guy named Barry Ira Geller. And when I first moved to Hollywood, we were living in the same building. We were neighbors. In fact, my apartment was right directly above his apartment. Somehow or another, you know, we met each other, became friends. And one day he offered me a job to help him work on his Lord of Light project.
The Lord of Light, is that just, was that the Amber series?
I don't think so. I think it was a standalone.
Okay.
Two of the people we had working on the project were John Chambers and Jack Kirby. Jack's doing all of the production design work and character models.
Oh, wow.
So at least once a week, I was driving out to Jack's house in Thousand Oaks, I think is where he was living. Either pick up art or drop art off. And Roz would always greet me at the door, then usher me back into Jack's studio at the back of the house and hang out with Jack. And at the time, you know, I kind of remembered who he was from, you know, the mid-60s when I was a big comic book reader. But I wasn't consciously aware of, you know, that I was standing and talking with, you know, one of the comic gods of the Pantheon.
Wow.
And I just, you know, it was just this, I don't want to say old guy. I mean, I was probably in my mid-20s. And of course, I was blown away by his art. But also at the same time, having these conversations with this, I felt like I'm just not smart enough to have these kind of conversations with this guy. It's like, he is out there. But clearly he and Barry were right in the same wavelength.
Yeah.
So, but neither Barry or I knew any of this until years later. I guess Errol Morris had done a documentary about the CIA guy, and he spilled the beans.
You have met some incredible and worked with some incredible people. Holy crap. I'm blown away by this Kirby thing, because I was already blown away when you were talking about Lynn Wein and Wolfman and everybody else, but I don't even know what to say about yeah, comic books have always been, it's a lifelong thing. I've waxed and waned on how many titles I buy every month, but it's never been zero, and it's never broken the bank. So it's somewhere in between those two.
When I started working at Sunbow, I hadn't been reading comics since the mid-60s. And I think, and this is a story I'm sure everybody tells, my mother had thrown away all my comic books that I had from her. But when I started, because of Sunbow and Steve Gerber and Marv and Lynn Wein and Marty Pasco and all these people who had come into comics around the same time as my writing partner did in the early 70s, you know, we started working together and hanging out. I sort of got that, I think I might be interested in looking at these comic books again, even though I never read any of the Transformer comics or G.I. Joe comics that Marvel would send us, because I did not want to be influenced by their stories and then, you know, subconsciously liberate them for my own.
Yeah. It's been the same thing that Dixon and Flint and Larry Hama have all said the same thing about, I guess, in reverse for Sunbow.
So I remember, you know, started going to San Diego Comic Book Convention and Golden Apple, and I'd see these old comic books that I had when I was a kid, and I would just get this rush that I couldn't really quite explain, but I felt like I was 12 years old again. A little drugstore with soda fountain and spinner racks holding the same book in my hand. I had to recreate my whole Daredevil collection, and then I kept, you know, stumbling on new books by new artists. I'm like, oh, that's really great. And so I still have most of those. When I packed up my stuff to come back to LA, I gave a lot of my long boxes of comics to my son, but still kept quite a few. But that's, again, when it comes to collecting, I'm really afraid becoming a collector again. So the only thing I have currently is I have the big, Frank Miller's big Sin City omnibus, the hardcover version. I have a few Jeff Darrow hardcovers.
Oof.
And, two IDW put out these two big Darwin Cook books, Darwin Cook comic books of his Parker series.
Yeah.
Which I'm a big fan of. But I was also, you know, before Darwin started illustrating those, I was a big fan of the Richard Stark books to begin with. But man, I know there's some incredible stuff out there that I'm just afraid to be exposed to.
That's fair. Have you gone back and read any of the G.I. Joe comics or the Transformer comics after you were done with Sunbow and Deke, now in the later years, now that you have some distance?
Mostly because I don't have access to them. Mm-hmm. And speaking of Josh, I wasn't even aware that he had his own comic book company and that he was publishing G.I. Joe. I just thought it went straight from Marvel to IDW.
Well, and I think that was a lot because they just considered it, they rebranded everything he did as declassified and just washed it away as not canon. But Larry even worked for Josh's company, writing G.I. Joe for under Josh's company, Devils Do Productions, or Devils Do Publishing. I always say productions. Yeah, Josh shepherded the comics version of G.I. Joe for 7-8 years.
Is Hasbro that kind of wants to pretend that doesn't exist?
I don't know if it was Hasbro or if it was IDW, if it was a combination of the two. You know, that's not a question I've broached just out of politeness when talking to him. But for whatever reason, those have kind of been relegated to no longer canon or side universe or whatever you want to call it. I own all of it. I've read it multiple times. Do you, now that you're back in LA, do you still go to Golden Apple Comics? Is that your store?
No, the last time I went was a few weeks after I arrived in town, and they were doing, Kevin Eastman was making an appearance at Golden Apple, something turtle related, and I don't know what specifically the event was for.
And you worked with Kevin and Peter in the past, haven't you?
Yes.
See, again, you've worked with the greats. You've worked with all of them.
Yeah, I started out as a consultant for them for about a year, and then they offered me a staff position. So I left DC Comics to go to Mirage Studios in Northampton, Mass.
That's incredible. I know this was meant to be a G.I. Joe conversation, but now we've talked about Orioles, comics, Kirby, and I love how your entire career has based basically in all the things that so many of us love. Wish we had known you sooner at this point now, right? And we've shared many a drink at this point. So the next time we get together, it's just going to be picking up like old times.
Yeah.
I don't want to minimize what you did on G.I. Joe by saying you wrote 5 scripts, because you did so much more than that. You have over 80, 90 credits as a producer. You also did the, I think what we talked about in AR, and I think it's on the panel if people want to watch it on YouTube, was you did about 20 of the 24 PSAs. What is the role of the producer in terms, like, we all know what a writer is. We all know what a voice actor is. What's the role of a producer?
Well, for that show in particular, it was sort of shepherding the script from beginning to end. I know one thing that might be difficult for diehard fans to want to hear is, at the end of the day, working at Sunbow was just a job.
Absolutely.
We all had jobs before that, had jobs after. And it was, I don't want to say, you know, it was a sausage factory, but it definitely was assembly line. If you want to think of it as like an auto plant. In both the, on Transformers and G.I. Joe, I had little to no involvement in terms of selecting writers or reading pitches. That would be the story editor's job to pick what stories and writers attached to it that we're going to tell. But once that script was completed and submitted to me, I had to see to it that Marvel got their copy of the script. And the way I remember it, it seemed like every Friday afternoon, I had to deliver a new script to Marvel so that before the end of the day, they could assign a storyboard artist to begin work on it. Now, sometimes it would be one artist, we'd do all 3 acts. Sometimes it would be 3 artists, each one getting an act. I guess it would depend on the pipeline, what was happening. So that's what would get the ball rolling. When the storyboards came back, it was my responsibility to then review the storyboards and compare them to the original script. Then I was also responsible for supervising the voiceover recording sessions. So I'd sit in the booth with Wally. And as I told you earlier, you know, originally we'd do table reads, but eventually evolved into actors just show up. They look at their, what they call sides, and they, you know, they see their character's name. They go, bullshit, 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 my line, bullshit, 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 my line. And if they had, you know, very few, they would go to Wally and say, Wally, let me just do my six lines and get out of here because I got another show to do. Also, if lines that worked on paper but didn't really work in the room, I would be there to be able to rewrite them. So one thing that's really key in writing an animation script is everything that happens that you see on the screen, you have to write in your scene description. So if you have a character who enters from, you know, frame left or frame right, you have to write it in. If you have a character who's running towards the camera, you have to write that. You know, lasers coming in, whatever it is, all that stuff has to be written. You can't just write a general description of the battle scene. You have to break it down in all its components and be very specific about what's happening. And a lot of times, you know, for certain characters, especially with Transformers, you know, we just make up a lot of names that would be like a twist on. Like DevCon is just a twist on DefCon. Well, one of the characters in that episode is some alien lord, and I'm going to spell this out for you, G-Y-C-O-N-I. Now, when I finally saw the episode, everybody was pronouncing his name as Lord Gaikini. And I went, what the hell? That's not his name. It didn't occur to me to literally write the phonetically how you should pronounce the name, because the character's name was a mashup of Gary Gygax, who I used to spend a lot of time in his house. The handful of times I ever played D&D, Gary Gygax was the DM.
Sweet Christ, man. Okay, we'll get to that.
So the guy part was for Gary Gygax, and the cone part was for Flint and I have a mutual friend named David Marconi, who's a film writer, director, probably most famous for writing the Will Smith movie, Enemy of the State.
Great movie.
So his name was supposed to be Lord Gaikoni. Guy for Gygax, Coney for Marconi. But they called him Gaikini. And it's like, oh. So that would be another good reason for me being recording sessions in case people were mispronouncing characters' names.
So as a producer, you kind of just, once the script was written, you just kind of did it all, working with the different departments and the different teams and making making sure that the product got made appropriately.
Correct.
Wow.
So then once after recording session was done and the animation work came back, whoever the Marvel director of the show was would assemble a rough cut close to running time and would send me a 3/4-inch tape of it. And so then what I would sit down, instead of sitting down with the script, I'd sit down with the storyboard and make sure that all the scenes matched up. And at the same time, look for animation errors, which, as you know, were a lot.
They happen, sure.
And the thing, and a little sidebar, nobody ever told me this. I sort of came up with this theory on my own. After doing so many Sunbow episodes, G.I. Joe, Transformers combined, what I became aware of was the better quality of the storyboard, the better quality of the animation, which is why any script that I wrote, I would always try and get Larry Houston to be the storyboard artist because I knew it would be beautiful. So anyway, that was the sidebar. Going back.
That's a great sidebar.
Looking for animation errors. Now, the deal that I guess Marvel had with whatever overseas animation company was working on a particular episode was they would fix those animation errors, but they would only do 10. That was the maximum number that we could ask them to fix. They would fix more than 10, but we'd have to pay them additional money. And it would also mean the show would be late.
So you had to prioritize the worst of the errors and let some go.
So I was always told, just pick the worst 10. Well, I couldn't leave it at that. I would pick them all. But then I would highlight what I thought were the worst 10.
Yeah.
And hopefully the Marvel director attached to the show would have agreed with me. I know I hear a lot of fans online about the animation errors, but what they don't realize is all the animation errors that were so grievous that got fixed. So then, yeah, so that was my responsibility. And then the final one would be then the mix session. We'd mix the music and the dialogue and the sound effects. And we used to do that on the Paramount lot, Ryder Sound Services, which was a thrill for me to drive on, say, at least once a week, to drive on Paramount lot, park my car in the old pool, which they still use. It was kind of a sunken parking lot, but they used it as a pool to say, you know, when they did World War II films back in the 40s or 50s, and they had, you know, these scenes of battleships, they would shoot it in this pool, and then the wall of the soundstage, you know, would be painted.
Oh, wow.
So when it was not in use, it was a parking lot. The wall of the soundstage was this brilliant blue cloudy sky. So it was great to do that every day, or at least once a week anyway. And I would sit in what was like a giant empty movie theater with two, sometimes three sound mixers. And we'd go through the whole episode. And so that would be sort of my final responsibility with the show.
That is a lot.
It is a lot. But I was doing multiple shows. But if I remember correctly, it seemed to me from the time the script was submitted to Marvel to go to storyboards until we had a final product that was ready to be delivered to Claster, about 6 months. So it was just multiple shows in different stages during the course of that 6 months. So as I said, it was a, you know, kind of assembly line production.
So you are a scheduling and a spreadsheet master before Excel was such a thing.
Oh, I don't even think I did any of that. You know, it was really old school. I mean, I would get a fax, you know, with the schedule of, you know, what days we were going to do what for each week.
Wow.
I would just show up. And then, of course, you know, then, as I said earlier, the idea of writing the PSAs, creating Captain Claymore and Special Mission Brazil, all of that sort of came under my purview.
We talked about this in Iowa. You had sort of looked at the PSAs as being garbage, and all of us love the PSAs. And then we had talked about how they had done the spoofs of the PSAs and everything else, how important those are to our community. I know they're goofy, and no one really gives a damn about, like, don't touch the dog or, you know, don't swim after eating, but all of us love the PSAs. We all love them.
I imagined at the time, or maybe I felt at the time, that they were so cheesy. And I think I kind of knew it was pretty blatantly obvious what we were trying to do with them. But I, you know, I didn't give much thought other than, okay, well, this is what we're doing. And I kind of figured, I think, that they wouldn't, that the kids watching the show wouldn't respond well to them because it's like some adult telling them what to do. But I could see when I first became aware of, which might have been around 2003, 2004, a friend of mine's son was telling me about all these PSAs on YouTube that somebody had rewritten the dialogue for. How after the fact, the cheese factor of it made them more charming.
Yeah.
But at the time, I just can't imagine that anybody would respond well to them.
As a kid, I wasn't responding to them as in like, oh, Roadblock has given me good advice about power lines. It was more of just, it was just an extra 2 or 3 minutes of your favorite character interacting with kids, which, we're kids. We want to interact with these guys, you know? It really was just eking out that just little extra bit of character voice in our heads. Because when you're playing, you know, it's not all Duke shouting, get 'em. You know, having those extra bits of dialogue and being able to then, you know, as every kid does, do the bad, the awful Australian dreadnought accent, or the bad broadly European Baroness accent, or, you know, as a white kid doing the awful Biloxi, Mississippi, black guy accent. We were enacting our favorite characters, and those PSAs just gave us a little extra voice. I don't think a single kid was ever like, oh shit, I can't jump in the pool because I just ate and Lifeline told me not to. I don't think that ever happened. But all of us watched them. We all loved them, and we carried them to the point where when we all saw the PSAs, the spoofs, same time you saw them, it wasn't like, oh yeah, I remember these. It was, oh my God, this is an amazing homage of love and silliness out of this little extra bit at the end of all of our favorite cartoons. I don't think they ever landed poorly with any of us kids. I think they just were just a little bit of an extra voice, you know?
Well, that's good to know. Yeah, those spoofs. Somebody asked me if I was, you know, offended by that. And I said, absolutely not. I think they're brilliant.
Well, you're a writer. Why would you be offended by fun writing?
Yeah.
If they were written poorly, then maybe.
I just wonder if those... I recently read an article about the guy who did it, and I can't remember his name now. But if he hadn't done those, I wonder if the popularity of them would be the same. If they had just still existed in their original form, would people be talking about them? And I'd like to think not.
Well, I think, and knowing is half the battle would still be just as popular because it's very catchy.
Yeah.
It's catchier than Yo-Jo. You feel less silly saying, and knowing is half the battle, kind of the same way you do the, and that's what she said.
Yeah.
But screaming Yo-Jo in the middle of a conversation is always a bit weird.
And everybody who uses Yo-Jo knows what it's from. But I think there's a large segment of society who use knowing it's half the battle unconsciously.
Yeah.
And aren't even aware of its origin.
That's probably true in today's world.
They just heard it so often.
Man, I have eaten up 2 hours of your day, and I'm having fun. I'm not apologizing, but I'm also trying to be respectful of your time. But you had mentioned that you knew Gary Gygax. It's, again, you knew all the comics greats, all the animation greats, all the voice actor greats. You're one of the writer greats, and now you also know the father of tabletop role-playing games.
Yeah. He was renting a house in Beverly Hills, at the top of Beverly Hills, that was once owned by King Vidor. Very famous. If you're not familiar with him, look him up. Director. Probably going, starting with the silent films.
Okay.
Through the 30s up through the 50s. Kind of a Art Deco style house. And this great piece of property. It was all flat. Overlooking Beverly Hills Hotel and the city beyond. And I remember there was, you know, come through these gates and then big, long, sort of oval driveway. And I don't remember how Flint had and Gary had become friends first. And somehow or another, Flint's family, and maybe it was just who was involved with D&D. Maybe she was running it for a while. I can't remember. Nor do I remember the chronology of it. But in any event, Flint and Gary were working on a series of Choose Your Own Adventure books that I think originally were going to be Conan books. And for whatever reason, that didn't work out. And then it became Sagard. So Sagard, in a sense, really was Conan, but they didn't have the rights to it. So Flint and Gary were writing these things together. And King Vidor had built near the entrance, there was a horse stable, which had converted into a little office area, lounge area, and a gaming area. Gary Gygax was really big on, these small figures for role-playing games. And he had built this huge sand table that we took advantage of. And every Sunday night, we'd get together and play these different role-playing games. And I'm hard-pressed to remember the one specifically that we played almost weekly. But every week, it was one of us would take turns in designing the game and then being the referee. So we'd have to sit out. We couldn't play. But it's also where, at the same time, is when I first started writing animation. And it was for Dragon's Lair, the Don Bluth video a video game that Ruby Spears is doing. So I was writing my scripts up there. It's also where I had my bachelor party. And so in the dining room of the main house is where Gary would set up this long table that he'd be at the end of it, where we'd play Dungeons and Dragons. And I was aware of it, had never played the game before, thought it was really interesting. And I'm not sure I thought about it at the time, but certainly in retrospect, it was kind of cool that the only time I ever played the game, Gary Gygax was the dungeon master.
So right in the heart of the American Satanic Panic, you are at the table of the godfather of this hobby.
Yeah.
I love it. So I don't know if you're aware, but I think it's in March every year in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, where Gary was from, his son still puts on GaryCon.
Yeah, which I think Flint goes to almost regularly. Is it Ernie or I think the other son's name? Wasn't Gary Jr. There was Ernie and...
I have mutual friends, but I've never met him, so I don't... I'm going to space on the name as well. Because I have mutual friends, I'm going to get yelled at, but that's fine. I don't know the guy. But yeah, I didn't know if you were aware that they were doing that. I didn't know that Flint Dealey was that big into role-playing games then or carried into now. That's very cool.
Yeah, because at some point, I think his sister bought TSR.
Okay.
So Flint, and Flint and Gary were really good friends. And I think Flint, his association with Dungeons & Dragons grew even more when his sister bought the company. I don't know who owns it now.
TSR shuttered and Wizards of the Coast owns the Dungeons & Dragons brand, which Hasbro owns Wizards of the Coast. So essentially... Hasbro, who you've been in bed with for years, is now the shepherd of Dungeons & Dragons. But TSR had the Marvel Super Heroes role-playing game. They had all the D&D stuff. They had a ton of things all the way through the late 90s when they shuttered.
Yeah, and I know, I don't know if you know this or not, but Flint's family owned the rights to Buck Rogers.
It did not.
And I think they made it, because I know we were testing it a lot. TSR did a Buck Rogers role-playing game as well.
So if you are if you're a Sunbow fan, you have ties and you like Flint's work, you have ties all the way into role-playing games. We hung out for what, 3 days in Iowa. We told each other tons of stories. We talked about our families, and all these other things, and yet even still after 2 hours, we're still talking about things that we didn't even address the last time we hung out. Codename Iowa is their company name. Assembly Required is their live show. It happens every year. Brian Sauer, Travis Weber, their team, they do an incredible job every year. This was their 12th year. And every year, as you saw, Brian is a designer. He is an artist. Ron Wagner, who is, a Marvel Comics legend, lives in the same town. Brian puts on a show that is papered as if it were a large, 20,000 person convention. The artwork is fantastic. Knowing that you and Blaylock were going to be guests, he did a Claymore file card for you to sell at your table. He did a Zanya one for Josh. I don't know how people can get a hold of those cards now that the show's over, but Brian is fantastic.
When I kept stumbling across this thing called Codename Iowa and Assembly Required, I was blown away by the artwork. As far as I'm concerned, he's the gold standard, and every year he keeps raising the bar.
Agreed. His show is not the biggest show. His show... And he and I have talked about this at certain times in his show's lifespan. He's liked it small. He's kept it small. Right now, he's growing it and he's stretching his wings. And I think anybody that shows up to a show once is going to show up 2, 3, and 15 times.
I walked away feeling like Assembly Required, and I don't mean this in anything but a positive way, that it felt more like a class reunion.
Yes. I go to a lot of conventions, toys, comic books, role-playing games, etc. I tend to miss a lot of the like Star Wars and Star Trek because they're just cost prohibitive. But I've found that the commerce is not what brings me to a show anymore. It's the after commerce. And so like when you said Simply Required feels like a class reunion, that's what I want out of a show. That is my goal. If I'm going to spend $1,000 on a weekend, I'm not going because I might buy the rarest thing. I'm going because I get to have that class reunion. I get to embarrass myself and see my friends embarrass themselves. I get to tell stories, hear stories. Joe Fest, because of some of us who really push that aspect of a show, Joe Fest is like 5,000 people. It's much larger than Assembly Required. But a lot of the people that you met at Assembly Required are going to be the same people that are driving the after show hangout in their two-story lobby. So it turns into a larger version of that thing. Becomes a bit more chaotic, but it is one of those shows where if you want to be in the belly of the community and hang out and tell stories and clink glasses, it's a good show to go to.
Yeah, it seemed like in my limited research of trying to find conventions that I could introduce myself to see if there'd be any interest, it seemed like that was the biggest and the most likely, as opposed to, I see a lot of these sort of local, you know, comic book events, which brings in the fans, but doesn't necessarily bring in any special guests.
It's all about the commerce, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm very interested in being invited to Joe Fest. But I do feel like, and not just because it was my first, but because I still feel with my limited experience, it's the gold standard. I will be comparing every convention to Assembly Required.
I tend to as well. I've taken up now 2.5 hours of your time. I apologize.
You know, we can always, you know, somewhere down the road, near future, we can always schedule another session.
You know, I'm always available if you want to hang out and chat, if you want to, as long as I am of a value, right? You've met me. I can talk for days. So if I have somebody on, I want to make sure that I am of a value to them.
It was great hanging out with you and talking to you about this stuff. This is stuff that I haven't talked about in years because I've never had a reason to. There was nobody, you know, at a certain point, there was nobody in my world who was interested that I had done this.
Yeah.
And probably most people didn't even know that I had done any of this because I was so far removed from it. It was just never came up in conversation because I'd done other things. So part of it is sometimes digging deep, trying to remember. But in the process, other things just start floating up to the surface on their own. And it's also kind of validating for me because I just assumed for so many years that, you know, what small contribution I had made to what became this huge franchise, I didn't really think had registered or resonated with anybody. And I was okay with that. So sometimes, you know, and especially because of the focus on Cold Slither at Assembly Required, it becomes very surreal experience for me to just be visually all this Cold Slither stuff being boom, 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 in my face when, you know, almost 40 years ago, it's just a throwaway idea that I figure people will watch one day, and if they're lucky enough to catch the rerun, they'll just forget about it.
And none of us did. Let's end it here. Thanks again for spending time with us discussing toys and other geeky things. Our logo was made by Rhino. The music we use was created by Self Help. You can find Joel on Instagram at Order of Battle Pod. Jason is on Twitter at Order of Battle PD. Our email is orderofbattlepod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, and thank you for your likes, comments, outreaches, and just being here with us.
This has been The Order of Battle.